You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This is a non-com pod, but it is nonetheless a conversation with a comedian, albeit a newer one. Pope Lonergan is my interviewee for today. He's a fascinating character. I don't want to tell you too much about him because I sort of discovered him throughout the course of this interview. He came to my attention a little while ago. He's certainly been putting himself about on social media and offering interesting things. He runs a show called The Addiction Clinic. He is an addict, a former addict. There is going to be some pretty upfront chat. I'm going to disclaim this with a general content warning for talk about addiction. We will cover some thoughts on suicidal ideation. But I also want to stress that unless those things are genuinely triggering for you, you should listen to it anyway, because it isn't a dark, bleak, awful kind of a chat, nor is it a light, breezy look at the funny side of addiction. But Pope is much more than that. He is a really erudite character, and there are some couple of shout outs, couple of references to some astonishingly highbrow authors that at the time you'll probably hear me go as if I know what the fuck he's talking about. But he's very, very literate, very well read. It contrasts nicely with his voice, which does not necessarily sound very literate, depending on your own privilege and your perception, your expectations of other people's accents. But he is very honest. And he's very funny, and I think that you are going to enjoy this. A very quick thanks to Tom Dewar, who upped his subscription very kindly. If you're a member of the Insiders Club, there's actually no extra content with this episode. It was just a quickie. But all of the episodes of recent times which have extra content, you can get hold of all of that by joining the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. And Tom Dewar is the latest in a short, but what's the word for when you love some? Cherish. A short but cherished line of insiders who have been upping their subscriptions during the pandemic to support a thing they love. Thank you very much to Tom. New insiders, freshly joined: Richard Lucas, Simon Harding, Ian Pringle and Debbie Pirrie. Thank you very much to all of you. And Caroline Glover and Ellie Lynch have also made donations to the show as well. If you want to do any of that, you can do it at comedianscomedian.com/insiders and find out all about the extra content there. The Infinite Sofa is going phenomenally well. We had Dara O'Brien last night, and it was everything I dreamt it would be. If you'd like to see the bit where I say, "You shut your whore mouth, O'Brien," then we can. You can find that at infinitesofa.com. There's a link at the bottom of that page to all of the previous episodes of my brand new, well, it's episode 14, but we've done it in 7 weeks, so I'm still calling it brand new, my massively interactive chat show. It's like a massively multiplayer cross between Gogglebox and Graham Norton, and it's going great guns. So I hope you'll check into infinitesofa.com and find out all about it. And of course, while we're in a plugging mood, Chops Comedy is a new material comedy at 8 p.m. All of these things are found at twitch.tv/Stu Goldsmith if you're on Twitch. And if you are on Twitch and you're an Amazon Prime person, you can link those two things together and give me a supportive little, I think I end up with £2.49 at no cost to you, other than the cost of your normal Amazon Prime subscription. So that is technically a cost. I'm unable to ever mention that without caveating it somehow in a way that is entirely unnecessary. Now, let's get back to this episode. I think you're going to love it. This is Pope Lonergan. My guest today, and his face you can see next to me, is you're Pope Lonergan, but your Zoom info betrays you. Your real name is clearly Liam.
Yeah, because that's what it says. Of course, yeah. I forgot to change it. I now behind the veil. Yes, my stage name is Pope Lonergan. My real name is Liam Lonergan. So
why Pope? Where did Pope come from?
It, do you know what? It was just a play, like, you know, like Beck when he wrote the song "Loser." They said when he was doing in the studio, he just kind of came up with like stream of consciousness lyrics, and then they became the lyrics. It's like, okay. I use Pope Lonergan as a placeholder on Facebook. I didn't want anyone to sort of find me who I worked with. Okay. And then I think it was Richard Gadd where I started getting booked as Pope Lonergan if I was getting booked through Facebook. And Richard Gadd said, oh, is that your actual sort of stage name you use? I said, like, on and off and that. And he said, oh, no, keep it. It's a very kind of interesting name, especially if people think it's your actual name. But now I've fucked it up because
now we know your real name. Yeah. We can bleep it. We'll bleep it on the podcast. Yeah, yeah. 10 people on Twitch will know, but no one else. I see now you have, while speaking to me, changed it up. That's very impressive.
Yeah, yeah.
That's very good mastery of multitasking. So, well, I agree with Mr. Gadd on that, because Pope, I think, it's very eye-catching. First came to my attention, I think, a few years ago. You'd been mentioning stuff or kind of stuff on the Comedians Comedian Facebook group, and I remember it was Pope does certainly jump out in a way that Liam perhaps doesn't, because it kind of connotes. Where are you from?
Essex, so yeah, Southend on Sea, yeah.
Okay, interesting. Because to me, Pope, and particularly with Lonergan, it sounds, obviously Lonergan's an Irish name.
Yes, that's right, yeah, yeah.
So Pope works particularly with that, because you think, who is this guy? It's almost like Don Rodolfo, Kieran's character from the last couple of festivals. So what we're going to talk about today is a couple of things. We'll talk a little bit about your comedy. You're 4 or 5 years in, did you say?
Yeah, yeah. So I did my first ever gig 5 years ago, took a hiatus for about 9 months. So I always say, sort of coming up to October, it'll be about 4 years of actually performing.
Okay. And who were you before comedy?
I was sort of someone...
I mean, to be fair, it's only 4 or 5 years. You may still be that person, but who have you been for most of your life?
Yeah, I'm very much probably still that person. I was I was a drug addict, number one. Thank God that isn't something that is present in my life now. But I worked in elderly care. I've done that for 8.5 years. And I studied... I'm sort of one of these people. I studied English literature and creative writing in uni. Got a first as well. But I like when I was talking to Alfie Brown about it, said I'm one of these people who studied that, but I still say things like, I've done a degree in English literature and creative writing. So, yeah. Another comedian said, I'm someone who's intelligent but sounds thick. And I think that's just about right. It's the...
Yeah, that's quite a fun dynamic, isn't it? To be able to... You can play to... lots of different types of person, I guess. You can make a palatable message. I remember from your set at Chops, you were doing. Who was the person? It was an author. Was it Hemingway or someone?
No, James Joyce.
Of course, it was Joyce.
I'm obsessed with Joyce. I do a Bloomsday event, like a comedy event, to celebrate James Joyce every year. And I mean, mainly the thing I really intrigues me about him is this idea of ennobling the body's lower stratum, of turning our base functions like shit and piss and vomit and any kind of effluent, turning that into something tinged with poesy. And I'm someone who's had bowel problems. I've got Crohn's disease as well. Obviously, working in elderly care, you know, you're cleaning these people, and a lot of the time you're wearing their hemorrhoid as like a cufflink. That's a big part of elderly care, is cleaning up feces. And that idea of like the grotesqueries of our biology really intrigues me. I find that fascinating, and Joyce is really big on that.
Let's talk about being a drug addict, because I know you do Pope Lonergan's Addiction Clinic, which is a live show, then a podcast, and now a Twitch show. Is that right?
It's a live show. I haven't turned it into a podcast. I tried to get a podcast off the ground talking about addiction. We've done a few episodes. We've gotten a really good response, but they didn't carry on with it. It's a live show. Now I've migrated it to online, and I've been doing it with Next Up as well. It's a slightly changed doing it online, but I've been doing that show for about 2.5 years now.
And to what extent do you... I feel like, and forgive the term, I feel like the addiction thing is kind of inescapably part of your brand, if you like, because you're sort of someone who, in the same way that Russell Brand did, you're kind of weaponising your former life, a life that... I don't know, what are your feelings about your former life? Let's just spend a minute kind of setting you up, given that it is part of what you do. How did you fall into drug addiction? What kind of addiction are we talking, and how did you get out of it?
Okay, so from the age of 13 was the first time I drank alcohol, for instance. Straight off the bat, I knew it was going to be a problem because I liked it too much, that feeling of just kind of flying above yourself, flying above the parapet of this actual material existence. I always wanted fucking transcendence, and any way I could attain that, I would leap at the chance to do so. Then, so drink played a role from the age of 13. Then I got on to sort of party drugs, recreational drugs and stuff. Quite a bit later on, to be honest, probably about 19 when I went to university. I actually remember, so I was in, went down to university with my mum and dad. And my housemate went down with his mum and dad as well to help move our stuff in. And the minute our parents left, he went to me, "Have you ever done pills before?" And I went, "No." And he went, "Do you want to do some now?" I went, "Let's go for it, man." And straight from that, it was like drugs were all consuming, like all through the day and night. I'd have a routine of like waking up and getting Frosty Jacks, which, if people don't know, they're these 50p cans that are like 12%. They're like, they're pure chemicals, disgusting. Yeah. I used to get like a massive six pack of them and hold my nose and down all of them just to start the day, like just to get up in the morning.
Christ.
And then like my housemate would show me like a video montage of like beheading videos or something. It's a horrendous lifestyle I led. And then I'd get like 6 grams of, it was methadone for a long time, so that was when it was still a tenner a gram. Then it became illegal, so it's no longer that cheap. And then just the whole day would be spent kind of navigating myself through the world on any substances I could get hold of. And
would there be any moments of clarity if you're getting blasted on cider first thing in the morning? Would there ever be a come down where you would feel like your actual unmedicated self?
Yeah, there'd be like pockets of lucidity throughout the day, and them moments were agonizing because you had to confront. It's also knowing that the come down is just around the corner. And so like there are moments of clarity when you realize that is potentially imminent if you don't keep going and keep taking drugs, which is horrendous. But yeah, fun as well. I mean, there was plenty of fun times in it. The Boris Dad was like an 18 day bender, nonstop drink and drug use. And we'd just be playing cricket in our garden on this like little broken slab of concrete in the garden, just playing cricket throughout the day or just sitting. Yeah, it was horrible existence for a long time. But
And how much transcendence did you actually achieve?
Probably quite a lot at the beginning, but as time went on, as the years went on, not very much at all. And I was always one of these people who was a very solitary drug user, so I wasn't even doing it for social reasons. And like, if I did end up going to a party or whatever, I'd have like a party boy gram that I share amongst people so they think I'm sociable, but then I'd have 4 grams tucked in my back pocket for myself. And in the end, I'd spend the whole party going into the bathroom, putting like a black bag over myself to muffle the sound of me snorting drugs because I didn't want anyone to know I had more drugs on me. Yeah. And I'd sit there in that bathroom, muffling the sound, covered in a black plastic bag, thinking, this is hell, but I do not want it to change anytime soon.
Even in that kind of a moment, you were like, this is, looks to camera, this is brilliant.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it was always when the come down would come eventually, and they were the moments when you know it'd be awful. But then, weirdly enough, I came out of that, had 2 years of like sobriety, of clean time, and got into a relationship with someone who had borderline personality disorder. So like an addict, someone with BPD, very tempestuous dynamic. And it was sort of, yeah, it was going well initially, but then the fault lines started to show in that relationship. I had Crohn's disease. My face looked like a fucking sinkhole. I was lagoon green. I had a plait. This is when you know I had a plait that went down to my back like that. Mm. So I was always walking around in a dressing gown and a vest with bolognese stains down it and these weird kind of, what they, I can't remember, like these patterned leggings. And I was prescribed opiates to manage the pain from Crohn's disease, which actually every gastroenterologist would tell you is madness. It's madness that I would have been prescribed that. But then in the end, they were just chucking different opiate medication at me because it was completely mismanaged. So I had like, you know, bottles of morphine, I had dihydrocodone, I had MST, and with MST you can, you know, smash them and snort them to release the to get around a slow release mechanism. And all this kind of, you know, opiate drugs were chucked over to me by doctors, by medical professionals, and then life just, yeah, got really, really sort of pure stasis. Just life paused for about 5 years.
So that was another period. So you got clean. How had you got clean the first time?
I don't know. I think I moved back home. I think it was the year because I'd had a very staggered education with viewers. This feels like it's getting a bit dark and bleak. I'll try and inject a bit of humour into it.
You needn't. That's the other thing I should have said at the beginning. Don't feel there's any pressure to be funny. Okay. And I should also point out as well, just while we've kind of almost paused, how old are you, Pope?
30.
30. Okay. Because I'm trying. Because people listening to this who haven't seen you, because of the timbre of your voice, they might assume that you are considerably older and considerably less baby-faced than you actually are.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the stories you're telling about the abuse you've inflicted on yourself, I know guys who've been through things like this, you know, former, you know, street performers or associates thereof, who would tell me stories like this. But even if they're 40, they look 60. Whereas you are a very fresh-faced 30-year-old. So, you know what I mean? You really have come out of this in a surprisingly cherubic, bearded, cherubic kind of a way. So let's get back into it. And don't worry if it gets dark, just to speak as you're comfortable speaking. Don't try and be entertaining. Certainly.
Okay, great.
We're talking about the period through which you pulled yourself up from six cans of Frosty Jacks in the morning and methadrone and all the rest of it. To I mean, that's clearly, you were addiction. You were an alcoholic.
From like the ages of 13, and like I'd had problems with alcohol and alcohol dominated. There would be different moments. Like alcohol dominated at one stage in my life, and then moved on to drugs, and then it moved on to prescription opioids. And
okay. But in that gap, I was really fascinated by that relationship gap whereby you were in the grip of addictions and then you went completely clean for 2 years before it started again.
I think, it was, it wasn't even a conscious decision. It was the first time I'd been in a relationship for starters, and even with that, it was like an unusual. I kind of can't talk about it too much. So I wouldn't want to disrespect my ex because there's no like hostility there or bad feeling.
Okay.
And I've sometimes been a bit candid about stuff on these, and she's got to be upset. But it was a strange courtship in that right at the beginning of us getting together, she had to move in with my mum and dad, so we all had to start living together.
Okay.
And my mum's like quite unapologetically bolshy, like 5'2" Essex mum. My girlfriend at the time was also quite a boisterous, exuberant personality.
I'm loving seeing you navigate this part of the description. Yeah.
Without denigrating those two specific people and without saying something that just sounds overtly sexist, which I really don't want to do, obviously. And yet they would both they would both like fight. I remember I once had to throw a wardrobe down the stairs to stop them hitting each other. And it was kind of I felt like if I put drugs on top of that circumstance, even though later down the line I would use drugs to numb myself to those kind of situations. But at that time I thought if I'm having to, you know, use and then go through withdrawal and use and go through withdrawal, the moments of lucidity, of clarity, to then be confronted with this, like, domestic turmoil, it just felt like I can't. It's too much all in one go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's, I feel like that's an instinct for self-preservation that maybe is missing with other addicts, to think to myself, oh, I better knock this on the head now. It's, I feel like, you know what I mean? I feel like presumably lots of addicts want to improve their domestic situation, but you were able to. Do you feel like the grip of your addiction was maybe less vice-like than in the case of other addicts, or do you think it was self-control or an instinct for self-preservation that was different?
No, it's definitely it permeates every part of my being, that like addictive tendency. It was, I definitely haven't got a handle on it. I don't believe in what some people believe, that it's a matter of willpower.
Sure.
I believe in the idea of self-binding. So, like, if drugs are there in front of me, I couldn't stop myself. I just wouldn't have the capacity to do so. Mm. But what I can do, which does require a bit of willpower, is not allow myself to be in situations or put myself in front of visual cues that will bring back, like, euphoric recall. And there's certain ways of engineering your life to prevent you from using drugs, and that's called self-binding in sort of recovery terms.
Okay. The only real addiction I think I've had, besides, I was going to make some glib joke about not exactly performance, but maybe glibness. I think glibness is the main addiction. But the only kind of chemical addiction I've had is nicotine.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky to read the Alan Carr Easy Way to Stop Smoking book, about which I'm evangelical, read that about 20 years ago, and gave up overnight whilst reading it and never looked back. And I do remember the central principle of that is that I have to regard myself as a recovering nicotine addict for the rest of my life. Because if I have a single cigarette, I'll be right back there on day one. Mm-hmm. And actually having that very... Pete Dobbing described it to me as the way the book... He gave me the book and he said, the way this book works is it's kind of like, it's not hypnosis. You know, and I don't know whether it is technically NLP, but it really made a lot of things kind of very clear for me in recognising the addictive personality within myself. Or not even the addictive personality, but the simple fact of the chemical addiction to nicotine. It's incredibly good at... it made me challenge and logically bust all of the excuses that I would give myself as to why I was allowed to have... Well, I've just broken up with someone. I'm allowed a cigarette. And it made me really realise in a very stark, very vivid way, oh, those things are simply the addiction talking.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I don't know, because it's like when I went to I'll be getting a bit ahead of myself, but I've always been I've never believed in this idea of a stigma being attached to addiction. I come from, like, where I was talking about my mum before. She's always cultivated this environment full of, like, full disclosure and, like, complete transparency. Just get it all out there. Tell your mummy. but my dad, and this is where it's going to come as a show, my dad is actually a detective sergeant. So my dad is a bit more prudish in a weird kind of way, and a bit more reticent about me revealing so much of myself. I think I've always been quite aware or quite attuned to my triggers and to the parts of my personality that are problematic and what I need to do to stop myself from dropping in a catalyst for that addictive manic behaviour. So, yeah, I mean, it manifests itself in weird ways. Like they said that Leonardo da Vinci, he was believed to be a gay man, and that because he could never express that desire through sex, that he had what they call sublimated addiction, and that's why he became very prolific in his work and then would, you know, doing loads of different things. And like, yeah, my sublimated addiction like manifests itself, like I do a bit on stage where I talk about getting addicted to books about the Hawaiian judicial system, and that's not far off. I start reading about the Hawaiian judicial system, for instance, and then I buy like 7 books on the Hawaiian judicial system. I mean, okay. I'll only like I might dip in and out of one, but I'll mainly read the blurbs and then I move on to the next thing to get interested
okay.
in.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
okay. And at what point did, I mean, we casually often refer to stand-up comedy as an addiction. At what point do you think that's something that you've sublimated
yeah.
your addictive personality into comedy?
Oh, 100%, yeah. And I know the exact moment, I can pinpoint the exact day that occurred. And it was during the Camden Fringe in 2017. So I think it's the 29th of August, right at the end. And it was my return to stand-up comedy after like a 9-month hiatus, and I had this booked in. It was just like a double header with my friend, my close friend Michael, who is now a comedy writer, doesn't actually do stand-up anymore. But something just opened up, and there was like a real transformation in my on-stage demeanor, because before I was always like really sweaty and manic and going all over the place, mainly because I was on drugs or coming down from drugs or something like that, whereas this was I was completely clean. I'd had 9 months post rehab of coming back to comedy, and I just sat the fuck down. It seems like a really simple but very effective device of, I just got on stage and sat the fuck down. Just sat down. That helped to anchor me. That helped to ground me and allowed me to be in control while in that space. And that was the first time I'd ever enjoyed doing comedy, even though by that point, I'd had done it quite a while. I'd done quite a few, not in comedy terms, like I'd hardly done it at all, but I'd had quite a few sort of bigger gigs there, and before that it always felt like a punitive thing. It never felt like a fun, leisurely, enjoyable thing, which is, you know, it didn't seem fun to me, but that was the first moment it seemed fun. And the audience was about 3 people, but it was the most fun I'd had doing comedy up to that point.
Let's stay with the word punitive for a minute. So let's just go back in the timeline. You were clean, you were in a relationship, you got into opiates, and did you say for about 5 years you were sort of lost in a stasis, you said?
Yeah, like a liminal state of just, I had this kind of like, there's a book called Oblomov, which I really like, and it's, I always said like an Oblomov in existence. It's this man who kind of just drifts around, doesn't achieve anything. It's kind of bathroom hopping all the time. And there's another book called The Bathroom by Jean-Philippe Toussaint. That's the same, similar sort of thing. I love that.
And these are books that you've read beyond the blurb on the back.
Yeah, these are ones I've actually read. I read, boy. But these are ones I actually read and enjoyed. And that idea of a sort of sedentary lifestyle and inertia and boredom and all that kind of stuff, I find deeply, deeply fascinating, mainly because that was my life for 5 years. I was just stuck in this tiny flat and with a girlfriend where both of us were just waiting for the other one to die so we had an exit route from that relationship. Like, we were both hoping to get that phone call where we're like, oh my God, she's dead. And then be like, cheers, mate. Yeah, you've really sorted me out there, boy. Thank you for that.
Well, I am glad to hear that was reciprocated. Yeah,
we even in the relationship, we would both joke about how, like, we were being very honest and candid with each other. about how we really despise each other, but we're inextricably bound together. And we could actually laugh about that even while in it. It wasn't even like a retrospective thing. I'm like, oh, God, what hell? Even in a moment, we're like, this is fucking hell.
And that was a codependency, was it?
Yeah,
was based on your mutual needs as people who were, well, in your case, addicted, and in her case, a BPD experiencer.
Yeah, definitely. 100% pure codependence. And it's a shame that my first ever relationship was built on those kinds of foundations, because as we know, it's extremely unhealthy to have that mutual need, because you're both gonna fall short on what you require from each other, because you're both very damaged people. And we would swap between the caregiver and the person who needs care, the caregiver and the afflicted, and we'd both interchange those different roles all the time, and we'd both be frustrated that we were designating that role to the other person. So yeah, terrible sort of relationship to be in, a codependent relationship.
Mm. And where did you, that carried on during the 5 years of your opiate addiction?
We were together for about four and a half years, I think. So yeah, we were together for four and a half years.
And then what got you, was that your most recent addiction, that you got clean of opiates? What was the turning point for that?
Yeah, it was, I'd like to say it was this like road to Damascus moment, this like epiphanic moment of like this. I mean, it was in a way, because I did, like, leading up to that, I'd had 4 months of thinking the bottom has got to fall out. Like this is not sustainable in any way. Like the bottom has got to fall out eventually, because this is no life. I wasn't seeing anyone. I wasn't doing anything. I haven't even got the kind of reckless, like, hedonistic, druggy stories to feel like it was all worthwhile.
That addiction was different in that it didn't offer transcendence so much as what?
It just offered. I think you're always chasing that. So the initial feeling of taking opiates in the early stages, I always say it's like fresh air thoughts and a stomach full of moon glow. That's just a thing I've written before. And that is the feeling you get of like all the cobwebs in your brain have been lifted. Everything has resonance. Everything seems really profound and engaging. And you want to have conversations with people. And you can have that for quite a long time, because people aren't necessarily aware you're on it. It's not like MDMA where, you know, your eyes are like saucers, you've got a swinging jaw. It's not clear in those early stages of opiate abuse that you're even on anything, apart from you might seem a little bit more excitable for an hour a day. But yeah, then it got to a point where I was like necking back 60 dihydrocodone tablets, like in one go. I was drinking bottles of like oxycodone or Oramorph. And this is stuff they give to terminal patients. This is stuff that they give to people who are dying. And I was down in pints of this stuff.
So your stamina is presumably extraordinary, which is probably something of a blessing and a curse for the addict, because you're able to go harder than anyone. I mean, you lived through this. What you're describing sounds like it would have killed me, for example.
It would kill me now, like, because you build up a tolerance. You adapt to the levels. It's incremental. It takes a while to get up to that point.
And do you look back at that? You were talking, sorry to interrupt, but you were talking about the experience of opiates, and in the early days you feel more engaged and like fresh air thoughts. Now, looking back at that time, do you feel that that perception was real, or do you feel that that perception was flawed based on the opiates changing your ability to perceive what was actually meaningful or not?
Yeah, absolutely. It was the second one. It was all illusory. Like it didn't exist. You feel like you have like a heightened sense of connection with people and stuff like that. None of that existed. It was all false. And I really understood that when I went to rehab. And in rehab, we had to do a diary at the end of the day. It's a long day, rehab. You have like a lot of different things you're doing. It's actually very busy. And then at the end of the day, we had a diary. And my therapist would always say, "We love reading your diaries. It's like a short story. It's like a vignette or something. It's really really well written and enjoyable to read and stuff." And they said, "Obviously you've been doing a lot of writing since you've been in here." And they said, "I bet that's the most amount of writing you've done in like 5 years." And because initially I'd always kid myself into thinking that opiates were like sparking up the brain and they were stimulating me and they were giving me access to sort of, you know, different perceptions, not like hallucinogenic, like doors of, you know, opening the doors of perception or anything like that, just allowing me to feel more in step with the world. Because I suppose every addict feels like they've had a severance from everyone else, from people, and they're always trying to reestablish that connection with other human beings. And that's what I feel like all the time. Like I can be a gregarious like socializer in short bursts and stuff, but most of the time I'm a very hermetic, like at home just reading or writing or knocking about with a load of people with dementia, which I love. I enjoy that. I was saying on a podcast the other day, I said the hour within the care home, the final hour where all the sort of hectic, frantic daily stuff that you have to do within the care home, where I'd just be sitting with four other people with dementia, making them a cup of tea each, and we're all just kind of chit-chatting, but like we're all chit-chatting as if we're talking together, but all the conversations are occurring like independent of each other and stuff. And so, but those final moments I lived for. They were something very meditative and beautiful about those moments that I really enjoyed.
Before we get on to that work, and I that really resonates with me, I think before my granny passed away, she had dementia for several years, and I think of my family, I probably was most okay with it, in terms of being with it, certainly to begin with, until everyone else got used to it, purely because I've been to parties where people have been having hallucinogenic experiences, and I've had a few myself, and I was like, oh, I understand when she's sort of, you know, my mum would refer to it as, oh, you know, granny's rambling. But really what was going on was she was hallucinating a sort of mesh, and she was going, what is that? What is that mesh that's everywhere?
Yeah.
You know, there was, I think I was a bit less freaked out due to my own sort of very minor psychonaut history. I was like, oh, go on, I can engage with this and sort of talk her through it. And I feel I've talked people down, if not from actual ledges, but from kind of hallucinogenic ledges before. So I felt I was a bit sort of forearmed.
I've said that before. I've said the nearest, for me, the nearest experience I've had that I assume is a sort of facsimile of that situation is when I would, same thing, when I'd go to house parties and I remember everyone would chuck their powder, didn't know what everyone had, they'd chuck all their powders into a bowl and then we'd just snort indiscriminately from the bowl. So you don't know what you're getting, you're just, and you feel absolutely, you feel absolutely, I remember I gave myself, during one of those situations, I gave myself an epididymal cyst because I tried to drop my bollock through the letterbox to surprise the postman. And the letterbox flap got caught on my bollocks and created this like thing in my epididymis. don't do powder.
I mean, I was I was about just before the epididymal story.
Yeah.
I was just about to feel like I felt like we should caveat this story by going, in the name of God, don't mix a load of random powders together,
don't.
Because you are lucky to have survived that.
Absolutely.
But I think possibly you've the warning at the end of that is its own caveat.
So this is Pope. I didn't really talk about at the top of the show the sorts of things we were going to say, other than that kind of content warning, but more to come, more on the search for transcendence, more on his work in care homes and a comedy tour of care homes, more on two extended periods of alarming addiction coming up soon. We'll get back to Pope in just a second. Just a reminder to go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders if you would like to support the show, and not just support the show, but actually become part of a community that is becoming more and more tight-knit with every passing day, and to go to the Infinite Sofa as well. That's infinitesofa.com, no the on that URL. infinitesofa.com to find out all about that. And if you have any ideas, whether you're an insider and you want to mention these in the Slack app, or if you're just listening on a casual basis, parry this. If you want to email me info@comedianscomedian.com or even engage with me on social media @comcompod, then I would love to know your ideas for massively marketing something that is brilliant. I think a lot of us, when oneself is the subject of marketing, what a clumsy sentence that was. What I'm trying to say is, it's always been easier for me to tell the world how great this podcast is than it is for me to tell the world how great I am as a stand-up. I could do with being a bit more American and a bit less self-deprecating than I am. Certainly people have listened to this show for years and assumed that I'm average as a comic because I say disparaging things about my work. And of course, in my mind, what I'm doing is proving that I'm part of the club by being diffident and, hey, you know, same old shit, man, about something I value highly and am excellent at. But that's the point I'm making. In terms of the Infinite Sofa, it's just so good, and I want everyone to watch it, not out of a sort of shameless sense of 10xing the audience and making a ton of cash, although that too, but mainly because it's glorious, and I feel like it's like flypaper. Everyone that checks in on it and sees it is like, oh, this is good, and stays. I just did a great interview this morning with Si Hawkins for the British Comedy Guide. I was interviewed by Si, so that should be coming out soon. I'll link to it in the show notes if we get there in time. If not, I'll ref it in the ComCom Facebook group. But he's thrilled about it as well, and it gave me a real shot of adrenaline to go, yeah, right, this is working. So infinitesofa.com for all you need on that. I think I'm going to pause the working lunches for the moment. I've had loads of requests, and I've even taken on some repeat clients, if you will. So I've sort of forged some ongoing relationships there, but I am probably at capacity there with all the other things I need to do. So let's pause them for now. And if you hear me talking about this and it is any later than, say, June 2020, then you can probably go to comedianscomedian.com/lunch. And by then I will have gone, no, I need the money and I'm going to get back into doing it. Let's say freed up the time. I've freed up the time. And I need the money, and I'm going to get back into doing it. So, very last thing. If you go to, you know, the British Comedy Guide, I mentioned it earlier. How sweet. Oh, God, that's the sort of thing I'd have set up to deliberately segue into if I was any kind of producer. It's a website which has got all sorts of stuff there. They've got enormous traffic. It's a brilliant, brilliant site for anything you want to know about comedy news, interviews with people, stuff like that. But there is a thing called comedy.co.uk/pro for anyone who wants to start out in comedy or progress. There's exclusive articles. I've put a few things on there. There's insights and advice from people. There's a hub of opportunities. There's a competition on at the moment where three writers have their script optioned and pitched to TV channels by former BBC and Sky comedy boss Lucy Lumsden. And you can expand your profile on the guide. They get over 500,000 visitors to the People Directory every month. I mean, all of this sounds too good to be true, but the best bit is if you enter the code COMCOM on the joining page, you get £5 off. And you support the podcast, I get a couple of quid as well. comedy.co.uk/pro. Enter the code COMCOM on the joining page. You'll get a fiver off. All right, that's all the things. Let's get back to Pope.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Before we get on to the work with elderly care, I suppose I feel like you were halfway through a thought before about the... I'm very fascinated, given that you are so well-read, and we know that some of the great literary figures have experienced and experimented with drugs. Whether... Did you feel at the time... just this quality of whether or not that sensation of togetherness or a kind of transcendent awareness... Looking back at it now, you can say it was illusory. At the same time, I'm not sure what the question is. You know the way people with comedians always go, oh, they're all secretly depressed, and that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah.
Do you think it's true that in literary circles, it's easy for non-drug-taking critics to look at the works of whoever, Joyce, Hemingway, whoever, and go, oh, well, of course, it was all stimulated by his incredible experiences in the recesses of his, you know, the doors of his perception, that actually you might look at that and go, no, he was probably an excellent writer. And would maybe have been better if it wasn't for all the tremendous amounts of drugs they were taking. Where do you stand on that?
There's the thing, because I to be honest, that's all the revelations or the stuff I thought was really revelatory on drugs and on like hallucinogenics and stuff like that. I've never done anything with that. I've never done anything with those experiences. It's always been the quite sort of quotidian stuff around that of like, going into public toilets at like 9 a.m. to escape my girlfriend and turning the toilet cubicle into my own little makeshift office while I like neck 60 dihydrocodeine tablets and eat a bag of Monster Munch. Or it's always the bits of life that occur around what you deem to be, in your own head at the time, these really profound experiences. But I don't know whether anyone can really capture those moments properly and turn it into anything, you know, interesting to read. Kind of in the same way that when people describe their dreams, it's sure. Obviously you, because it's in that dream scape. It's an all-encompassing sort of sensory experience to you, so you're getting a sense of like the mood of the situation. Whereas when you just give it an itinerary of what occurred within the dream, people aren't feeling the mood of it and all that kind of stuff. And I believe that when you're sort of sending a transmission from, you know, a hallucinogenic realm, people aren't really getting how it felt to you, so it's boring to read.
Yeah. And did you? And just coming back to the timeline, there was the time on opiates, the end of opiates, and then did comedy happen after that?
Yeah.
When does comedy happen, and when does working with the elderly?
Okay. Yes. So there, it sort of all overlaps a bit. So I did my first ever gig in October 2015, and then I was doing comedy for about a year.
Can I just say, in 2015, why did you start doing stand-up?
So for a long time I'd been comedy adjacent, or kind of skirting around the edges of comedy. I did my dissertation on it, and I got to like hang out with people like, you know, Simon Munnery and Josie Long. And I've been a comedy nerd since I was tiny. Like, I've been a comedy... I remember my first ever essay I had to write in year three was about Rowan Atkinson and his life and works and stuff like that. So I've been obsessed with comedy ever since I was young. And I wanted to experience it vicariously through talking to people like Simon or Josie without actually committing to doing it. But then my mate Michael... signed us up at the Cavendish Arms. For those who are thinking of going into comedy, that's a really lovely place to start. It's a very warm, receptive environment. And yeah, so I started doing that. But then I remember I sort of about a year in, I got booked for one of Not Too Bag's gigs.
Oh, yeah.
And I was on the same bill as like Nick Helm, like Bridget Christie. I think Romesh was supposed to be there, but he didn't end up coming in. Like Liam Williams and all these people. And I was like a nobody. So when I was in the green room, like everyone was like, has anyone lost a little wanker? Like who's this? Who the fuck is this? Who's this little chancer? I was actually on the bill, and I remember I had so many pills and vodka in my system, and like no one would know, like no one was aware, because by that point I always took enough to make me feel nothing, but not enough to make a mischief. And yeah, I kind of went up, and it was my first big gig, you know. It felt big to me. It was at Rich Mix, and it was sold out because it was like the venue's like 25th birthday or something. And yeah, and I got up on stage, and probably like for that time, you know, really early inchoate version of a comedian, I probably did okay, like did quite well. But I came off and just felt nothing. Like I felt nothing at all. And then how long it was, probably about another 4 months after that, I think I quit comedy. And then the care home stuff happened. I've been doing that. I'm going to be like one of the people I care for now. Worrying over little details. Like I think Arthur had the red jacket on that day, and I can't remember when I first became a care worker. It's initially when I was in my second to last year of university, and I think I took it on to get a bit of extra money to tide me over. Okay. So, yeah.
Okay. And I've always, I think my wife's the same. She and I both have just a real profound respect for anyone who works with the elderly, because I think it's one of those, it feels like one of the most thankless good things you can do.
Yeah. That's very kind. It's become like a driving force in my life. Like I got commissioned to write a book proposal, and one of the objectives of the book is to completely overhaul how people perceive people who are living with dementia or some kind of neurodegenerative disease, because people talk about them as if they're like half dead, basically. And my guiding ethos is to embrace these people for every part of their lived existence, even if there's stuff that to us might be a bit embarrassing, or they might say things that are considered a bit tactless, or there's this kind of rupture in social graces. Really celebrate that in a way, because goes into what we do as comedians. Like a big part of our what we do as comedian is to kind of rupture social graces, and to embrace taboo subject matter and be transgressive. And yeah, there's certain behaviours that they exhibit as people with dementia that can be, it's not all just gloom and doom. It's a way for them to get in touch or get back in touch with their ludic selves, and this sort of sense of play and childlike naivete. And yeah, there's a lot to it. I'm banging on and rambling on about it. I've not been very clear.
I think that's fascinating, because I think it's almost like our attitudes to death. If you want to, death can seem like a thing which is like the totems of death can be a scythe and a skull and darkness and Victoriana and those things. But equally, if you kind of choose to look through that, then death can simply be like the end of a life or the next phase. I mean, not even next suggesting that there's any kind of an afterlife, but simply in a natural cycle of death and growth and rebirth. You don't have to treat it as one thing. And I think the idea, I wrote some material years ago about the dementia village that's in, and I'm going to forget, is it Hergesen? I think it's in Hergesen in the Netherlands, where there's, you'll know about this, where they've recreated a village And there are shops, but the shops don't take money. And there's a little bus, and the bus picks you up and drives you around the block and drops you back off. And it's a sort of a play environment whereby people can enjoy enjoy what there is to enjoy about their current situation. Stuff like that, I think, I suppose, having seen my grandmother go through it and being quite scatty myself, I've got a terrible memory, and I do have a sort of preoccupation, I suppose, that I will probably end up with dementia at some point. I wonder what that will be like. That's not necessarily a logical link to draw, but it's just something that's on my mind a lot. And let's not say a lot, but it's on my mind. So the idea of having, like you say, a ludic, a kind of playing environment for people, which is appropriate and warm. My dad lives in Spain, and I'm really pleased that he's now in a situation where there is an outdoor cafe culture, where if you're a little old man, it is expected that you leave the house and go and sit on a park bench on a nice balmy evening and watch the world go by, rather than in the UK, I feel like it's expected that you disappear somewhere where other people look after you until you die.
Yeah, I 100% agree. That is, we have unfortunately got a culture over here that isn't particularly kind to the elderly, which isn't to say, obviously, that there are people who are extremely kind to the elderly here and are very respectful and will go above and beyond to ensure that they're still visible, that they're not just tucked away. And and so that's simulated presence therapy. That's what you're describing in that village, and that's it's become kind of the standards. What they used to do was reality reorientation, where they would almost impose our own subjective experience, because I believe, I'm one of these woo-woo people, believes all experience is subjective and there isn't such, a deconstructionist approach. And there would be the standard was to kind of enforce that onto people and correct them and say, no, your husband's dead, you're in a dementia home. Imagine how discombobulating that must be for someone who it just assumes that their version of reality is how it actually is. But then there's been some talk, so now it's simulated presence therapy is the standard, or person-centred care, they say, in that there should never be a uniform approach to care work. It should always just be dependent on the person you're dealing with. So whatever their preferences are, allow them to sort of create their own care plan without forcing that onto them. But then there is stuff, say, quite compassionate deception sometimes, which I always believe is the best approach, because then you have that idea of like the eternal return, which is in Eastern religion. You have that with trauma. If you're forcing someone with dementia to constantly revisit a traumatic episode, so like the death of their husband, the death of their wife, the death of their child, whatever it is, if you're constantly forcing them to confront that over and over and over again, how is that good for anyone? How can that possibly ever be a good thing to force someone, to force someone to do? But then this is where I've got beef, and this is going, I've got beef with you, the British Alzheimer's Society, all the people there, obviously trying to do noble things, and I would never completely denigrate the British Alzheimer's Society. But then I'll see if I can find it. There was a statement released from the British Alzheimer's Society who was saying, I'll see if I can find it here. I won't faff about too much. If I can't find it in a second, I'll leave it. Because the British Alzheimer's Society have got like a noticeable deficit when it comes to researching like the emotional scape of those who are living with dementia anyway. They're too preoccupied with cause and cure, which is vital. We know that. That's absolutely vital research. But as well, they're not worried about what the holistic benefits of day-to-day care is. And they issued a formal statement saying, we struggle to see how systematically deceiving someone with dementia can be part of an authentic, trusting relationship in which the person's voice is heard and their rights promoted. And I said, but it's not you're not helping to you're not helping to sort of fuel a delusion, because a lot of this stuff that they're experiencing, it's like a memory. It's memory coming back to the fore. Yeah. Like it's not like they think they're a conker. If someone thinks they're a conker, you should probably go, mate, you're a man. Sure. You're a man. But they're experiencing memories and stuff they've experienced before. And I said, and there's also, how is forcing your subjective experience on these people a way of ensuring that their voice is being heard? Because you're saying, like, no, what your experience is rubbish, is nonsense. This is how you're supposed to experience the world. This is how you're what you're supposed to be seeing and feeling.
Yeah, sure.
And I've never understood that from the British Alzheimer's Society. Go on, sorry, Stuart.
To what extent? I mean, I absolutely take your point. I just wonder, in terms of your... I don't know if fascination is the right word. Obviously, there's empathy. That's perfectly natural and anticipated. But in terms of your connection with your interest in working with people who have dementia, which for many 30-year-old people that isn't an interest. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you think it's to do with? I'm not suggesting for a minute that that people with dementia are transcendent in any way, but is there a connection between the sort of casual approach to reality? Let's say a casual approach to reality and a sort of hyper-subjective version of one's own circumstances. Is part of what attracts you to working with people with dementia that, in the same way as that is partly what attracted you to the transcendence you sought with drugs?
I think that's something that might have occurred.
Tell me if that's bollocks.
I completely get the train of thought, and I think that there is definitely a connection there. It's not one I've thought about before, but I think I can 100% see that, and I think you're pretty correct in that. But it's like a lot of this stuff to do with the perceptions of reality within people of neurodegenerative diseases, that came a bit later on with research and sort of gathering information about this stuff. But my initial thing, I love being enmeshed in these people's lives. I love becoming an extension of their family. I love that they see me as kind of safe ground. Like they as soon as they see me, they know me, and they always would ask for me to be their carer. And they just become such a massive part of your life. I love just like knocking about with them and just like having a bit of banter between, you know, like, and setting up different things to, you know, like I'd always come in and do like shit karate or shit gymnastics. I realised anything that's a bit of a visual spectacle, they would find really funny. And I do stuff like, if you're just a bit naughty, like you do stuff like, I would, like, if I'm pouring milk, rather than pouring it like that, I'd put the glass right down here and pour the milk from right up there and see if I could get in the glass. And they would all go, oh, clever boy. And they liked the sort of the tension of like, is he going to spill it? Is he not? And just all these, I love like knocking about with them. I just don't know. I find it very rewarding.
You can tell from how you're talking about it. And it gives me a nice warm glow to hear you talk about it, and to think that some people's elderly relatives are being cared for by people who really love them. Of course, there's an incredible amount of that happening. And I think there's also always the possibility, the fear when one has an elderly relative in a care home that you just don't know how they're being treated. That's really lovely, very inspiring to hear. Are there lessons that you have taken, in the same way as you're kind of larking about, is something that's maybe inherent to you, but also something you play with in your comedy, taking that into a care home? Are there also reciprocal? Does it work in the other direction, that you learn something, the manner in which you deal with the elderly, that you learn something from there that you bring into comedy?
Not meditative like it's tranquil. There's not a tranquility to elderly care. There is moments in the day, but you're very much tethered to the present moment, because they kind of really inhabit the present moment in that everything is they're not really worrying about the future or what's going to happen next. They're kind of just observing and reacting to a lot of things that are going on around them. And I suppose that, which as we know, like in comedy, inhabiting the present and reacting to stuff that's going on around you and responding to stuff in the room and this stuff is very, you know, is a big part of the live experience, which is why I've said, I think we had a bit of the talk online about where I said the online gigs, like the one I did with Chops, I actually really loved. I thought it's a lot of fun and it was great. I said that just the one thing that's missing is this idea of occupying the space you're in and of prowling the stage and working out how just by going to this like nook on the stage can really maximize or create attention or whatever. I don't know, because there's certain subject matters that I deal with on stage are stuff like drug addiction or dementia or death. And there's that part of it, like I'm always fascinated by like the Saturnalian thing or the Baalist thing, like the Baal, I think that's how you pronounce it, is an ancient god. And their idea of like laughing at death and of turning stuff that's supposed to have gravitas into humour. And so it's a good way of like catheterising circumstance and temporarily draining it of its misery, which is why I always tackle this stuff, because I think it's a really... And Doug Stanhope, they posted a clip the other day where he said... make people saying you shouldn't make fun of that, and he said I shouldn't make fun. I'm a person who's making fun. How ridiculous! What an arsehole I am for doing that and for turning these, you know, these tragic, awful, heart-rending experiences into fun. What a wanker I am! And for me, you know, if handled in the right way and not seen to be laughing at, you know, like laughing at people who have dementia, more laughing at my response to people who have dementia or me being in an environment where, or my relationship with them and stuff like that. I think that's good. And I suppose being around it a lot is you get desensitized to it, and it allows you to do it in a way that's careful and not exploitative. I don't know if that's a good answer.
And normally at this point I would ask you what you want from comedy, what you ultimately want. We'll get on to that. But do you feel like, are you optimistic that you will remain free from addiction? Because you're so sort of eloquent and you're so centered at the moment talking about these experiences in the past. Yeah. Are you confident that you'll?
I relapsed before Chris. This is the problem. Like I relapsed just before Christmas, and I got like I hooked up again with someone who had borderline personality disorder. Should have learned from the last time. And then I ended up trying to. I took myself over to Amsterdam. Because it was the first time I'd been sort of sexually active in a while. I'd had a real like period of I'd like to say self-enforced chastity, but it wasn't. It was just circumstantial, just wasn't getting any. And when that started to fall apart, I relapsed. I took myself over to Amsterdam. And I popped a bag on my head, tried to asphyxiate myself and kill myself. Obviously, the last minute, I decided not to. Tried it for size once around the block, wasn't for me. And very quickly, after that experience, I turned it into like material. I turned it into, I got back on stage and I turned that into material. I said the problem with that is I love confessional comedy. It's what I do, but it does, it opens up like a chasm between the artifice of your kind of performative self and then the actual self that exists in the world. And by putting that stuff on stage and turning that into material quite quickly, it created a bit of a distance and a disjunct between what had happened and my emotional response to it. So I turned it into a bit. I don't think I've ever properly dealt with it.
I see what you mean, because I thought you were suggesting turning into it a bit helped, and what you're highlighting is that turning it into a bit managed to swerve engaging with it or coming getting anything out of it.
Yeah, exactly. So I've heard before comedians talk about comedy as therapy, like whatever works for you. Like everyone's got their own ways of dealing with stuff, and there's definitely moments of catharsis where I've talked about stuff on stage, but I think by turning it to material, it sort of deprived me of the necessary therapeutic processing, which, stand-up comedy, I don't think, should be a substitute for therapy, because I think I've never properly confronted what I did there. And then I ended up actually hiring a sex worker, not to have sex with, just to watch two episodes of The Good Place together, so I could stay safe. I bought an hour of her time, and we watched two episodes of The Good Place on Netflix, and then I sort of just said, like, shook hands, and yeah, thanks for a nice evening.
You were answering the question, are you confident about remaining addiction free, with the idea that you fell off the wagon, you relapsed quite recently.
Yeah.
What do you anticipate in terms of your mental state going forward? It sounds like it's a surprise to me to hear you had a recent relapse, simply because, and not knowing a great deal about addiction, simply because the package of Pope that we're talking to now is a former addict with a useful place in society, a creative career, and a history of experiences to draw on with great eloquence and humour. And that normally is something I associate with people who are way past it. If you're if maybe not in the middle of it, but you don't know where you are in it, what do you anticipate from the next 5 or 10 years of comedy, potentially care home work, and battling addiction?
So it's, I just want to say as well, like I have got in trouble on stage for talking about that recent attempt with a bit of flippancy and being a bit blasé about it. I'm not affording it the respect that experience deserves. So anyone listening, like, I understand suicide or suicidal ideation is a horrible thing. It's a terrible thing. And don't think I haven't dealt with it. So that's probably why I'm being a bit flippant with it. But with regards to comedy, I suppose I'm like, you know, I love doing it. I do it to satiate my ego, like I think a lot of comedians do it. I do it because it makes me feel good to leave an indelible mark on people's brains and to have an imprint on the world, and to like every time I go on stage, though, there is a bit of this toxic masculinity, because I said every time I go on stage, I have the same thought going through my head, which is I will show you how to love me. And then if it's a gig that didn't go particularly well, I'll walk off and my initial thought, obviously I get past this and I understand that these thoughts are problematic. But if it didn't go well, I walk on and think, oh, what fucking pussies. I didn't want you to love me anyway. Didn't want [S2] Sure. [S1] It that way. I wanted you to feel this way about me, but obviously that's like hurt, wounded, petulant masculinity, which is ridiculous, but it's quite funny as long as it doesn't turn evil. But yeah, with comedy. But then also I do want to use comedy as well for civic engagement or like civic participation, which is why like I set up the care home tour, which is comedy specifically tailored for people with dementia. We go into...
I remember talking to Tarjay about that. Was yeah. he one of the acts that did? Yes, okay.
Yeah, so me and Ben both created... It was my idea initially, and then Josie Long told me to go get in contact with Ben. Me and Ben got on like house on fire, you know, straight off the bat. Got this lovely dynamic between us in that, and this I'm quite a voluble, mouthy Essex bloke who you know who will be quite come across as quite extroverted, even though I'm not really. And then Ben has got this very zen-like Mayan, very contemplative. Will take maybe an hour to deliver one thought, whereas I just go yeah, and hope you can find something amongst sure. the thicket of my speech. So me and Ben did that, and then we got lots of different people involved who don't rely too much on like linguistic ledger domain or like anecdote. So really, I'm not well suited for it because I'm an anecdotalist or a confessional comedian. I tell stories which don't really land because for an audience with dementia, they can't follow the internal logic of joke telling or stories. But what they can really respond to is stuff that's interactive, that's ridiculous, and the silly spectacle and all that kind of stuff. And I'll just give you an example of the wonderful shows we did is that we try and treat it so that it's like an improv troupe where 3/4 of us have dementia.
Okay.
And I always find it works really well. So me, Jos Norris, Luke Rollison and Nathan Lang, we did one recently for the Leicester Comedy Festival. And it's good for me. I come on and kind of introduce myself and say what we're doing. And it works well if I set it up as like all the people in the room, you know, you're here to critique us. You can be the panel. You can be the ones to judge us. You can work out how much of our fee you're going to knock off because we're not doing too well today. All right. So we're going to do that. And I become a bit of like the whipping boy of that. They'd like take the piss out of me and stuff like that. And then Jos did this wonderful thing where he came out of like this box and he has to go round and all the residents have to put their most sacred and their most valued memories into the box. But then what started happening is people just started putting the actual house keys and stuff in there. And it looked like we'd come in to gouge the elderly.
But then
we turned that into a thing of like where we was guys going like you trust me though, wouldn't you, Brian? I've got a trusting face, and like Brian would go, fuck no. And then we'd like, and then yeah, it's just a way to like facilitate like conversation and keep this and would like keep this kind of keep this sense of play happening I don't really know how to describe it. It's always really wonderful when we do it though, and I'm always really respectful, like the residents who would rather fade into the background and don't really want to be a part of it, they're happy to sort of observe it passively without being a participant. We respect that boundary, allow them, but you always get about a third or half of them who really want to be part of it and be involved, and also we cede the floor to them a lot of the time. They're really, really funny in their own right, like they're like truly not saying that to be condescending or like, oh, aren't you doing well, my dear? No, they're genuinely sure. really funny, and we basically just go in and allow them to take the piss out of us. It's what it is, and it's always a lot of fun. It's great.
Are you happy?
Yes, I'd say, yeah, at this moment in time, the world's falling apart at the seams, but I'm feeling okay myself, so yes, I am.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers, Pope.
So that was Pope. What a fascinating life. What a fascinating series of choices he's made, and also to... I mean, I say to come back from those things, he's clearly still in a vulnerable position vis-a-vis his demons, his addictions. But to hear someone battling them in an ongoing and very intentional way, I find very inspiring. And not knowing Pope well at all, to discover him throughout the course of that interview and go from a position of, you know, obviously when I have someone on the show with whom I'm less familiar, but I feel like they're interesting, at the very beginning I'm thinking, I hope this is going to be everything I want it to be. And by the end I was like, oh my God. It's always one of those ones, I know it's good if I go off and say to my wife, oh, you're going to love this one. I mean, the stuff about the tour of elder care homes is so inspiring, and I do an awful lot of, I try these days to transmit more than I receive, but a lot of it is focused around this kind of obsession with comedy, which is very gratifying to me. I love it when people are more selfless than me, because it means I don't have to be. You can tell now, if you're a listener, if you've been watching The Infinite Sofa, you can tell that the parts of my personality that show is revealing through the fact I need to talk constantly for an hour or more a night. It's like a radio show, right? You can't help yourself come out. And it turns out I'm a little bitch. So more of that to come. But this is not necessarily the place for it. My point being, I respect Pope enormously and his work as well. And I think you should check him out. He's on Twitch. He's doing all sorts of stuff online. I'll put that in the show notes. But that's the end of the episode for today. I'm busy preparing for a special event. We're doing a private Infinite Sofa edition for the charity Calm, the campaign against living miserably. So I won't post-amble at you. Perhaps you'd like to spend the time instead looking online at all the fabulous stuff they do. I'm a big fan of theirs, and I'm hoping to be working more with them in future. But the other reason there's no post-amble is I'm a bit behind on my script. So I'm going to get to it now. Hope you enjoyed this one. I certainly did. Follow Pope on all the places you can follow him. Check the show notes. And I will be back with you in a week, next week. Oh, I've got one in hoc now. I've got in hoc, that's not the phrase, is it? I've got one in my back pocket. Catherine Cohen, who won the newcomer at Edinburgh last year. We'll talk to her. She's isolated and going crazy in the woods in Massachusetts. And we talk about her phenomenal skill set and the very different demons she's battling. And then the live record, which will be going out on Twitch at 1 p.m, twitch.tv/Stu Goldsmith. We're live streaming the new podcast 1 p.m. Wednesday next week with Roger Monkhouse. Come on! See you there.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.